Okay, today is Thursday, June 1st, 2017, and the time is approximately 9.03 p.m. Eastern. And in order to segue into what this presentation is going to be about, let's remember when talking to others to keep it simple. Our current problems and solutions are nothing new. They're the same today as they were from the beginning of recorded time. All law is contractual. There is always an offer and acceptance. Even in the Garden of Eden, there was an offer and acceptance. There was consideration. They were granted the world and all that is in it. All they had to do was just maintain it, just be good stewards of it. So there was full disclosure, and there was only one stipulation to that contract, and that stipulation was don't eat of that particular tree, and that stipulation was breached. Therefore, they were tossed from the garden. Okay. So, pursuant to Article 1, Section 10, there shall be no law impairing the obligation of contracts. Now, we have forgotten as a people where we came from. There were our ancestors that said, yes, we will obey those 10 commandments. Don't covet, don't steal, don't lie, be faithful, and don't take the name of, you know, the Lord thy God in vain. And here we have In God We Trust written on our currency, and one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. All right. Are these commandments being broken? Have we forgotten our oath of allegiance, our ancestral, who we are and where we came from? Therefore, that first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence is our funnel for the knowledge that is going to be imparted today from the historians of the past. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to, number one, even though the number one is not in there, the primary purpose was to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. Now, the political bands back then were the Whigs and the Tories. Back in the first centuries, it was the century, I should say, not centuries. Back in the first century, it was the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they had their scribes, okay? Today we have our lawyers. Back in, 1776, they had lawyers as well. Okay, so you know that a couple of meetings ago, I had mentioned about the theory and practice of banking. That first chapter defines rights, and it defines wealth. And we have, go back and read that so that we're all on the same page as what is marketable, okay? What do we hold title to? Do we have marketable title to our names? Do we have marketable title to the currency or the unit of exchange that we use? Do we have absolute ownership of our property, or is it all conditional? And if it's conditional, what is that condition based on? That goes back into contract law. Number two to that first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence was to, number two, to assume amongst the power, not beg and grovel for it, but to assume amongst the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God, laws of nature and nature's God implied the Ten Commandments, the coveting, the stealing, the cheating, the lying, the breaking up of families, so on and so forth. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind, however, require that they should, number three, declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And we talked about this either last week or the week before, that it's good to give a notice of fault. You know, is it misfeasance or malfeasance that you're doing this evil stuff? And give them an opportunity to cure. They'll either show their hand as being malfeasant about it, or, you know, they'll say, oh, gosh, we made a big mistake. We better fix this immediately. And this goes back to Matthew 18. You know, you go one-on-one, and if that doesn't work, then you go ahead and you take it before a mediator. If you can work out some sort of an agreement, you stay in honor. Honor is full acceptance, conditional acceptance. Dishonor is silence and argument. Okay? And that comes from Victoria Joy. Give credit where credit is due. And she did a wonderful job a few years back. An angel with an inkwell, I believe, is her website. So anyway, grand juries, we're going to get into the grand juries. This is an overview of its history and strategies for implementation with your local assemblies. Included in this presentation, which indicates it was given by a fellow named J.R. Manship to the Austin Citizens Grand Jury on 9/11 crimes. And it appears to have been prepared. It was a PowerPoint that I found because there were certain things I wanted to pull out of Edwards' grand jury to present that I meant to do last week, and we just didn't have the time to do it. But there is some fantastic stuff in his work that ties it all together and what we can do today with it. However, the only searchable document that I found about that is in John Rowland's site, the Constitution Club or whatever his site is called. And it wasn't going along with the page numbers that I wanted to give for the PDFs because the PDFs are on the NLA website. So nonetheless, with that said, when I came across this, I was just floored because he touched on everything I wanted to touch on. So I'm going to be reading with slight variations because the 9/11 does not, come into play right now. However, it is 9/11 crimes is what he was talking about. So you'll see how it goes as I go through it. If not, just ask questions. I'm okay with that. Okay, any questions so far before I get into this? Okay, I'm going to go ahead then. Okay, included in this is just about everything that's on the website as well, the NLA website. Okay, and that's Justice Scalia's word from U.S. versus Williams, that 1992 issuance there. There's Dr. Roger Root's fine Creighton Law Review on runaway or real grand juries are being quoted in this. And most of the other stuff comes from George Edwards' 1906 essay on grand juries, on the grand jury, okay? The focus of Manship's presentation are as applicable now as they were when he presented this PowerPoint to the Austin Citizens Grand Jury on 9/11 crimes a good 10 or more years ago. Citizens grand juries are the shield and the sword of the people, he says, the cornerstone of our Constitution, and we're going to go in and we're going to show why in all of that I'm going to present tonight. And it is the fourth branch of our government, the people's branch, as Scalia has said. So, a note on grand juries by George Edwards is what he started out with in Harvard Law Review, Volume 20, Number 8, June 1907. The grand jury is an institution of English-speaking countries. It is of historic interest by reason of the obscurity surrounding its origin, its gradual development, and the part it has played in some of the most stirring events in the history of Anglo-Saxon countries. It is of political interest by its protection of the liberty of the individual from the arbitrary power of the government. It is of legal interest in that its power and action is utterly repugnant to the experience and theory of English law. It has been extravagantly praised as the security of Englishmen's lives, the conservator of its liberties, and the noblest check upon the malice and oppression of individuals. It has been bitterly assailed as purely mischievous and a relic of barbarism. But although the Austin Citizens Grand Jury Project goals were specific for 9/11, they are relative to the development of local assemblies, committees of safety, and administration of common law grand juries. I therefore will leave it to you, the listener, to decide how what Manship presented is relevant to your particular matters. So here are the suggested goals for local common law grand jury administrators, okay? because we're in the process of training administrators for these grand juries that will come out of the NLA into the communities for the committees of safety and the assemblies as well. At least that's how I understand why I'm doing this. I hope it's correct. Okay. So, what a grand jury administrator is, or administrators will be doing in their communities, is indicting and prosecuting the criminals responsible for, in this case, it was 9/11 crimes, okay? So you fill in the blanks. What is it that you are going to be prosecuting criminals for? Who is responsible? Not what the crimes are, but who is responsible for those crimes. Restore the grand jury's power to protect the people from unfounded and harassing prosecution by the state. Restore, somebody is facilitating that onto the grounds of your local community. Who is that individual? I mean, it's like going back in time and thinking about the Scarlet Letter, you know, identify these people. And even in Nazi Germany, they had to wear this armband, right, to show that they were a Jew. We can mark. So restore grand jury's presentment power and the people's power to initiate and take over criminal prosecution when state prosecutors either refuse to prosecute or prosecute poorly. That's the job of the grand jury. Restore the people's right to elect grand juries and have them recognized by the courts. We began doing that back in 2013 with the NLA, and many of us have accomplished that. Restore the public's access to existing impaneled grand juries so the people can bring evidence of crime to these grand juries for consideration. Exercise the people's right to form grand juries to investigate crimes and present charges, especially concerning the crimes of, you name it, for your community. Publicize presentments and findings in various media to educate the public about who it is or what it is that is causing this, and to increase pressure on Congress and the Justice Department to thoroughly investigate the crimes of whatever it is that's going on in your community and prosecute those responsible. It takes someone giving the orders to continue on with what it is that they are doing. An outline of the topics follows. Grand juries have their purpose and function as a shield and a sword of the people. This goes back in history. The Magna Carta brought forth grand juries in England in 1215 AD. Grand juries became well established in England from 1215 to 1600s. Grand juries were in use in... Is someone talking? Grand juries were in use in pre-revolutionary America and served a crucial function in our revolution. Hopefully we don't have to have that kind of a revolution that was back in the 1700s. The power of grand juries continued in early post-revolutionary America. The imperative role of private prosecution, the decline of grand jury's power starting in the mid-1800s, and the 1946 procedure code. These are what kind of threw them out of use. Two modern cases highlighting the importance of grand jury's power in bringing a halt to government corruption were recent Supreme Court rulings. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have read two there, I don't think. Anyway, recent Supreme Court rulings reviving grand jury's power and function, reform to restore proper grand jury function, and the people's grand jury return to historic precedence. Media pressure needed today for the people's common law grand juries to have some serious impact. So we have to somehow or another get this into the news. And of course, with social media and, you know, the internet, we can do this. Grand juries are the cornerstone of our Constitution. The grand jury is the cornerstone of our Constitution. It, when it operates as it was designed by the framers of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights cannot be infringed upon by government. And this comes from Mike Brown, Information for Good Citizenship. It's at earthlink.net. Grand juries are the cornerstone of our Constitution. I'm going to go on with this. When I was taking it off of the slides, that the PowerPoint, I guess, didn't get everything out of there. So pardon me if I stumble through it. But I think you'll get it by the time I get down to Edwards, okay? Okay, so when it acts as a rubber stamp, grand juries are the cornerstone of our Constitution. When it acts as a rubber stamp for the prosecutor, the Bill of Rights are seriously undermined. So when the prosecutor gets involved, it undermines the Bill of Rights because it's not talking about us, it's talking about what they can do for who pays them. And remember, they're getting paid with a coin that is not according to Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution. However, by educating those called to be grand jurors, we can begin to reclaim those rights taken away by the federal judiciary. As a shield, grand juries protect the people from harassing and capricious prosecution by abusive and overreaching power of the executive branch. And that, you know, right there in the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment allows for voluntary servitude, with which if you do not comply, it's all about compliance, you're going to be duly convicted of a crime. This is where the feds came into, you know, our localities, basically, because we checked that little box, and by secession and acceptance, we were accepted into this unconscionable contract. So in order for anyone to be prosecuted for an infamous or capital crime, a grand jury must determine that there is sufficient evidence to bring that accused to trial. Grand juries are the shield of the people. Historically, this protection was mainly put into place to prevent the state from railroading people into jail or becoming involved in long and expensive court ordeals simply for being political dissidents or for disagreeing with the state. Now, remember, there were crimes under the common law, barratry, the exciting of lawsuits. Some of these laws just excite lawsuits. Maintenance, the maintaining of the lawsuits by, oh, you need a lawyer for this, you need a prosecutor for that, you need a defender for this. And they just continue to, you know, prolong the remedies for whatever it is that you're trying to bring. And of course, there is barratry maintenance and champerty, the champertus thing that goes along with it, and that is, oh, we need an agency for the aging now because we split up these families, now we don't know what to do with them, we need to go ahead and take care of them, you know, foster parents, so on and so forth. The grand jury shield is the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and that says that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on the presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. I'm dealing with an issue like that now here in Pennsylvania. The investigation of a grand jury will produce either a true bill or no bill of indictment. A grand jury votes on a set of proposed charges submitted by a prosecutor and can return charges in either of two ways. If the grand jurors decide there is probable cause to support the charges, they vote a true bill. That is, they vote to return the indictment and initiate a criminal proceedings. This is what we have the power to do, folks, and you'll see why as I go through this. If the grand jurors decide there is no probable cause to support the charges, they vote a no true bill, which means the indictment is not returned and no criminal case ensues. Grand juries are the sword of the people. The original name for the grand jury was the Grand Inquisition. As a sword, grand juries act as the accusatory and investigative body mainly into government corruption. We don't have to go to them for them to investigate government corruption. We do it ourselves, and we point out why. Grand juries may independently, and here it goes, grand juries may independently investigate corruption apart from the state prosecutor. Grand juries may conduct proceedings in secret and can question witnesses and examine physical evidence. Grand juries may submit criminal charges and other findings according to their own knowledge and independent investigation. This is called a presentment. Okay? So when you hear about a presentment, it's because somebody has done, it has their own knowledge and done their independent investigation. That is called the presentment. To the grand jury. Grand juries never consider any. Does somebody have a question?
Your voice is cutting in. Other people are having that problem or not.
Yours is coming in and out, too. Uh-oh. Can you hear me okay? Grand juries never can... Just stop me if we have to change something, okay, Jan? Grand juries never consider... Oh, go ahead. What?
Well, you sound good over here. Go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, okay, Gerard. Okay, so grand juries never consider any evidence whatsoever that may support the innocence of the accused. Okay? This surprised me when I read this. Grand juries never consider any evidence whatsoever that may support the innocence of the accused. It does not matter one iota if there are mountains of evidence to support the innocence of the accused. Grand juries only look at the accusatory evidence. If there is enough accusatory evidence to support probable cause, that is all that is needed for the grand jury. That is all that is needed for the grand jury to hand down an indictment or presentment. Any evidence to support someone's innocence is considered by the trial jury or the petite jury during the criminal trial. Okay, so the grand jury does not look to for the innocence of the accused. What they look is to either say this needs to go to trial or it is a no bill. Any evidence to support someone's innocence is considered by the trial jury, a trial by jury, or as is called the petite jury during the criminal trial. Grand juries are the sword of the people, and the Seventh Amendment guarantees us all rights established through common law. Common law developed under the inquisitorial system in England, i.e. the grand jury system, prior to it being called the grand jury system, from judicial decisions based on custom, tradition, precedents, and the history of jurisprudence. The right and power of grand juries to make presentments to initiate prosecution has been well established through the centuries of jurisprudence through common law. Therefore, this right was retained and protected in the Seventh Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The Seventh Amendment reads, in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of common law. Now, remember the common law, if it goes back to that first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, is considered, or should be considered, it's implied, the Ten Commandments. Was there coveting here? Was there a certain person with political pull in your area that wanted your property, you know, for instance? Was there lying or deceit that was involved with the contract that you were forced to sign in order to make that happen, like the Social Security number that was never to be used for identification purposes, being told that you have to put this on there or you can't get a driver's license, you know? Things like this. This is all issues that common law that probably cost more than $20 if you want to compare it to what $20 was in 1776 or 1791, when the Seventh Amendment was put in there. So, a note about common law and the Seventh Amendment, and common law jurisdictions includes criminal cases as well as civil cases. Common law deals with property rights. Most crimes involve a controversy which exceeds $20, especially when you go back and do the calculations. Use measuringworth.com and you can do the calculations clear back to 1776. The crimes of, and remember, 9/11 was, the crime that was being discussed, okay? The crime of da-da-da-da-da-da in your community certainly inflicted property damages exceeding $20 or personal damages exceeding $20, if indeed it is an issue, you know, in your locale. We are well within our God-given rights and entitlement and constitutional protections and defenses to pursue criminal grand jury investigations regarding crimes. There is no doubt about it, and I'm going to go on further to show why. Okay, so grand juries, and this is according to Scalia, of course, the fourth branch of government, the people's branch. It is significant that the grand jury is not part of any of the three branches of U.S. government. It is pre-constitutional. It is a pre-constitutional institution. In the mid-1800s, Washington attorney John H. Clark was reported to have written a motion to the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. In that he said, although today the grand jury is more of a prosecutor's panel, it is still pre-constitutional institution. It is still a pre-constitutional institution and is still a people's panel, not captive or relegated by the Constitution to a position within any branches, and it still serves as a vehicle for effective citizen participation in government. Citizens often mistakenly believe that because the grand jury meets at a courthouse, it is under the judiciary, or because the grand jury meets with a prosecutor, it is under the executive branch. It is not. It is still a vehicle for effective citizen participation in government. And you will see why as I go through this. And that end is quote, by the way. The grand jury is an independent institution adopted by the founders to protect the individual from prosecutorial misconduct, as well as to empower the people to initiate and pursue prosecution. Anton Scalia effectively codified the unique independent power of the fourth branch into the hands of all citizens sitting as grand jurors, including those sitting as federal grand jurors. In discussing that power and unique independence granted to the grand jury, the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Williams, and this is on the website, Justice Scalia, delivering the opinion of the court, laid down the law of the land. Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, and I'm not going to quote all of the citations. You'll be able to find that in U.S. versus Williams. I'm just going to read the wordings. So rooted, and this is the quote, rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three branches. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right. Okay? End of quote in that particular thing. And I just lost it all. Oh, man. Okay. I think I'm going to have to quit. Oh, no, there it is. Okay. Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, the grand jury, okay, I read that, right? Three articles. Okay. Scalia also stated that the grand jury is an institution separate from the courts over the whose functioning of the courts do not preside. In fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch of the institutional government, serving as a kind of buffer or referee between government and the people. Although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse under judicial auspices, its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. Judges' direct involvement in the functioning of the grand jury has generally been confined to the constitutive one of calling the grand jurors together and administering their oaths of office. And then it goes on to talk about Treasongate, grand juries, the fourth branch of government. And this is by Citizen Spook in August of 2005. And he makes some good points with this. So he says, or this particular, the author of this PowerPoint that I'm pretty much gleaning from, it says, I submit to you that the passage set the stage for revolutionary new context necessary and constitutionally mandated to we the people, the fourth branch of the government of the United States. Besides the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, I submit that there is a fourth branch, the grand jury, and we the people, when sitting as grand jurors, are, as Scalia quoted in U.S. versus Williams, a constitutional fixture in our own right. That is exactly what the grand jury is and what it was always intended to be. We have lost sight. It's not that it was taken away from us. We just have not pursued us, neither did our ancestors. And I can understand why, because many of them came to this country and they didn't speak the language and they just went to work. It was all about, survival instead of wondering what government was going to do, because it was better than where they came from, probably. Or at least they thought it was. So we the people have been charged with oversight of our of the government in our roles as grand jury. Let me read that again. We the people, and this is why that First Amendment is in there. We the people have been charged with oversight in our assemblies to redress grievances. Oversight of the government in our roles as grand jurors. This is the way it's done. This is what we can do with the committees of safety and through what has been formatted in the NLA, especially in the COS handbook, as far as the administration of the grand juries. And at this critical time in American history, we must, and this is going back 10 years ago, folks, that this PowerPoint was put together. And at this critical time in American history, this 10 years ago, we must, for the protection of our constitutional republic, take back our power and start acting as powerful as the other branches of government. We have been given that, and we are to assume amongst the powers of the earth that separate and equal station. The law is on our side. We, the people, have the right and power under the Fifth and Seventh Amendment and the First of the Constitution to charge this government with crimes by returning presentments, regardless of whether the U.S. attorneys or the federal judges agree with us. It doesn't matter. We need to do our job if it's going to get done. If it's not a runaway, it is not a real grand jury. And this comes from Roger Roots Creighton Law Review, Volume 3, Number 4, in 1999. A runaway grand jury, loosely defined as a grand jury which resists the accusatory choices of a government prosecutor. Okay? Read that again. A runaway grand jury is loosely defined as a grand jury which resists the accusatory choices of a government prosecutor, whether it's a local one, a district attorney, or whether it is, you know, out of the prosecutor's office or whatever, or if it is a federal one. Today's runaway grand jury is, in fact, the common law grand jury of the past. Hear that? Prior to the emergence of governmental prosecution as the standard model of American criminal justice, all grand juries were, in fact, runaways, according to the definition of modern times. They operated as completely independent, self-directing bodies of inquisitors. In other words, they investigated with powers to pursue unlawful conduct to its very source, including the government itself. There's always people that are facilitating. Oh, this is the way we've always done it. We can't change now. We won't get a paycheck. Now remember, they're getting paid with a coin that is not consistent with their oath of office. These are all things that kind of fit together at this particular juncture of time. Okay, so we're going to get into now George Edwards, and I love this guy's work, okay? The origin of the grand jury, and this is from part one of his essay. The origin of the grand jury has given rise to much discussion among legal scholars. This is going back to 1906, mind you, okay? Numerous and widely different conclusions have been offered. Some have claimed to find traces of the institution among the Athenians. But if such an institution ever existed in Athens, it has become extinct, or it had become extinct before the existence of Britain. Before the existence of Britain became known to the Mediterranean countries. Now, of course, Greece is in the Mediterranean area there. Athenian history does mention practices similar to the Normans' tradition of trial by large number of jurors. However, there is nothing in Athenian history that mentions an accusatory body of citizens. Okay? Some writers claim the institution has an Anglo-Saxon origin. Others urge that juries were unknown to the Anglo-Saxons and were introduced by the Normans after their conquest of England in 1066. The Magna Carta is the first major historical document enumerating an accusatory body of the people. That's what a grand jury is, an accusatory body of the people. The Magna Carta, the precursor, is the precursor of our Constitution. King John, 1199-1216, succeeded his brother Richard I. He lacked his brother's military prowess, and he spent much of his reign attempting to recover lost English possessions in France. To finance his military campaigns, he resorted to harsh taxation on his subjects, which provoked growing unrest. The Battle of the Bouvines in July 1214 marked the end of English hopes of regaining Normandy. Opposition to King John intensified. Now remember, King John's concessions to Pope Innocent III, he gave over the entire British nation at that time to the Pope and took it back as a feudal colony or a feudal entity to pay tribute to the Pope. So there's a lot of history here, okay, that you can kind of go off on those rabbit holes by yourself. I'm not going there. So opposition to King John intensified, and he was no longer able to resist the barons' demand that their liberties be confirmed. That's all we're asking our government to do, is just confirm our liberties, correct? That's it. Abuses by King John caused a revolt by the barons, who forced him to sign and enact this recognition of rights for both noblemen and ordinary Englishmen. It established the principle that no one, including the king or a lawmaker, is above the law. Now, what were those laws? Probably, don't steal from us, don't lie to us, don't covet what we have, don't break up our families, and so on and so forth. On June 10, 1215, the barons took London by force with their militias and forced King John to either sign the document or lose his head at the River Thames. In return, the barons renewed their oaths of fealty or allegiance to the king. The constitutional, see, they gave him a chance to, there's a fault here. Is it either misfeasance or malfeasance? What is it? Correct it. Okay? Opportunity to cure. They gave him an opportunity to cure on June 10, 1215. The constitutional importance of the Magna Carta lies in the fact that it placed limits on the absolute power of the king and made him subject to the law. So which law? Statutes and codes or the Ten Commandments? That is up to your local assemblies to decide. The most famous of the 63 clauses said that no free man could be imprisoned, outlawed, or exiled except by the lawful judgment of his peers. And that justice could not be sold, delayed, or denied. Now, I don't know about the constitutions of your particular state, but here in Pennsylvania, it is actually written in there as such. Not to be sold, pretty much the same wording. It also contained clauses relating to the treatment of the heirs and widows and to the payment of debts. It provided for uniform measures of wine, ale, corn, and cloth throughout the realm. It confirmed the liberties of the church. It sought to regulate the conduct of all local officials, such as the sheriffs, bailiffs, and constables, and to ensure that they knew and observed the law. And, I was kind of interested as far as the wine, ale, corn, and cloth, throughout the realm, uniform measures. And that's where the pint came from. So when you walk into a pub and you order a pint, that's where it came from. And one of the rights enshrined by the charter was to have your ale served as a standard measure throughout the kingdom. The provision which also applied, and this is what I looked up and got it through a United Kingdom website, which also applied to other goods like wine, corn, and cloth, was aimed at restricting the ability of merchants to shortchange people by selling things that looked bigger than they actually were. Now, I know that my grandfather had an issue here with being shortchanged on gas with a gas station that he had back in 1927, and that caused a lot of problems for the family. So just to, show that things like that were going on back then, and that is, lying and stealing from the people, right there. Okay, so the most significant clause for King John at the time was Clause 61, known as the Security Clause. It's the longest in the portion of the Magna Carta document. This established a committee of 25 barons, and I put this on the website in the comment section to look at 61, because 61 apparently, according to the English website that I went to, even though we have the PDF on the website, the NLA website, it does mention that 61 was kind of, you know, done away with. And you probably see why when I read through this fellow's interpretation of what it actually said, and it's pretty consistent with the regular English version, not the Old English version. But then again, the Old English version, it was, I guess, written in Latin anyway. So if you read Latin, you probably know exactly what it says. The establishment of a committee, and this is what 61 says, the establishment of a committee of, as interpreted, I should say, this established a committee of 25 barons who could at any time meet and overrule the will of the king. This is the power that we have today if we choose to do it and to just kind of get together and say, hey, look, we do have a remedy here. Through the force, by seizing his castles and possessions if needed. Now, I'm not saying go put liens on people and stuff like that. I mean, that's getting into commercial law. We're trying to fix the problem from the roots. This was based on medieval legal practice known as distraint, which was commonly done, but it was the first time it had been applied to a monarch. In addition, the king was to take an oath of loyalty to the committee. In English law, distraint or distress is a remedy for non-payment of rent. It involves the seizure of goods belonging to the tenant by the landlord to sell them for the payment of the rent. Using the practice of distraint as the founding principle of the Magna Carta is of significant importance. The barons asserted their right to seize the king's possession and overrule the king in the event that the king would not make redress of grievances to the people. This set up a precedence that the king as ruler is a mere tenant. Now remember, since silver was taken out of the coin, we the people are the creditors. The people, the barons, were the creditors to that king, so he was the mere tenant on their land. He was using their labor, their goods, their resources. We were human resources for a while. Now they're saying what we really are, and we're human capital, is what it says on the government websites now. This set of precedents that the king as a ruler is a mere tenant, and that the king owed payment to the people in the form of redress of grievances in return for the people allowing him to rule. Got that? We're paying them to rule, but we're allowing that payment at this particular juncture of time. We don't have to if they're wasting and abusing. That's contract law. That is corporate law. If redress is not made, the people have a right to seize his possession as payment. Up until this time, the right of the monarch to rule was considered absolute and unconditional. Now, with the Magna Carta, the barons asserted that the king's ruling authority was not an inherent right, but rather a privilege granted by the people that could be revoked by the people, and furthermore, a privilege that required payment to the people in the form of redress of grievances. If payment was not made, the people had a right to evict the king from his ruling position as well as seize all the king's possessions in lieu of payment of redress of grievances. And you can read 61 for yourself when you get a chance. The Magna Carta was the precursor of our Constitution. The Magna Carta reversed the tyrannical principle that the power to rule is an inalienable right of the elite and that liberties and rights of the people are granted by the ruling elite and can be taken from the people. And the first chapter of the book that I had mentioned in past talks, The Theory and Practice of Banking, kind of explains all of that and gives the definitions of rights. They are marketable. And if we choose to market them, they have become a lien. The proper principle was established that it is we, the people, who are the landlords and owners of the governmental positions of authority. That we, the people, grant the privilege of authority to the tenants of these governmental positions. This privilege can be revoked for non-payment of redress of grievance. Our tenants can be evicted from their positions, payment seized by confiscation of our tenants' material possessions, and most importantly, it is the liberties and the rights of the people that are inherent and inalienable. It is the liberty and the rights of the people that are inherent and inalienable. I say these words correctly. Okay, so the Magna Carta, Article 61, is the first accusatory body of the people in the Magna Carta. Since we have granted all these things for God, is what it says, for the better ordering of our kingdom and to allay the discord that has arisen between us and our barons, and since we desire that they shall be enjoyed in their entirety, with lasting strength forever, we give and grant to the barons the following security. These are pretty much quoted. The barons shall elect the 25 of their number to keep the cause cause to be observed with all their might the peace and liberties granted and confirmed to them by this charter. If we, our chief justices, our officials, or any of our servants offend in any respect against any man or transgress any of the articles of the peace or of the security, and offense is made known to four of the said 25 barons, they shall come to us. And this is why, you know, the NLA has got a good chain of command, you might say, you know, on the website in the handbook. They shall come to us or in our absence from the kingdom to the chief justice, in other words, someone in the administration facilities there, to declare it and claim immediate redress. If we or in our absence abroad, the Chief Justice makes no redress within 40 days, reckoning from the day on which the offense was declared to us or to him, the four barons shall refer the matter to the rest of the 25 barons who may distrain upon and assail us in every possible way with the support of the whole community of the land by seizing our castles, lands, possessions, or anything else saving our own person and those of the queen and our children until they have secured such redress as they have determined upon. Having secured the redress, they may then resume their normal obedience to us. In other words, put everything back on track. A side note is the invisible government speaks. King John had been forced to agree to the Magna Carta, and he immediately attempted to have it annulled by the Pope, who issued a papal bull saying that it was an unjust and unlawful, as it is a base. It is base and shameful, is I guess what Pope Innocent III said. Pope Innocent III annulled the shameful and demeaning agreement forced upon the king by violence and fear. He rejected any call for rights, saying it impaired King John's dignity. He saw it as an affront to the church's authority over the king and released John from his oath to obey it. Okay? So we have to watch out for these invisible, you know, hands and things. Okay, so a civil war then ensued, okay? So King John had no intention to honor the Magna Carta, as it was sealed under extortion by force, and Clause 61 essentially neutered his power as a monarch, making him king in name only. He renounced it as soon as the barons left London, plunging England into a civil war called the First Barons' War. What are we up against now? People are waking up, and, you know, I heard Captain John talking before the call got started. So we seem to be at that same place now. So grand juries are a Second Amendment issue, and this is by Michael Badnarik. The only reason the barons were able to assert and enforce their rights was because they were armed, and the king had squandered his army on imperialistic and unsuccessful war campaigns. The only reason we haven't had all our rights taken away is because we have the right to bear arms. We have the power to exercise and enforce our rights only as long as we can defend ourselves. Historically, one of the first things that tyrannical dictators have done as soon as they gain power is to disarm the people. Once the populace is disarmed, these tyrants can easily take away people's rights and liberties, install a police state, and begin the process of genocide. And this goes along with Guy Carr's book 2 that John had mentioned in one of the earlier programs. The Second Amendment was mainly put in place to protect the people from abusive and tyrannical government, Badnarik goes on to say, taking away not only our rights and liberties, but our very lives as well. Self-defense from common street criminals is secondary to this principle. Now, in reading further, I'm going to go back into history again, into 1906, George Edwards, the grand jury. And this portion is about the development of the grand jury. And we're already getting to the 10 o'clock point. May I go on, or shall I save this till next week?
How much more do you have, Nikki? Gerard wanted to make an announcement here toward the end, too.
I have about 4 more pages. So I have...
How many minutes? 20 minutes.
About 15 minutes. Is that okay? Quarter after?
How many minutes?
Okay. Let me go ahead and... About 15 minutes?
Gerard, are you still on? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here. I actually wanted to introduce.
How much time do you need?
Well, I probably need 10, 15 minutes myself. But I just want to do a quick introduction of what we have tonight, which is just to release the PowerPoint that's done now and get everybody to get a copy of it. I want to put a URL in anybody that has the ability to get that we have. I mean, I don't know how many callers do we have on here. I think
34.
Yeah, we were going to
34.
Look, we'll just send out an email, Jan, on this information that I have. I would like everybody to go and look at that PowerPoint. It's going to it goes hand in hand with Nikki's doing tonight, because it's the PowerPoint on the COS. And the militia, and you know, we want to start making inroads towards people like Christiane Hall, who has a problem with us because she doesn't believe in federal remedies. She thinks that we should stay local, but she doesn't understand what we're doing, in that we are grassroots and we are local. And when we go into the federal courts, we're going in as the sureties of the peace. Nobody's done that before, so she has a misunderstanding of what we stand for. However, the COS is a good place to start for her, because she's gonna, because she knows all about the militia stuff. So we got some whistleblowers and things like that are gonna be coming on to NLA, and I would like to get Christiane Hall to come in and do a couple of things, but look at our stuff, but introduce it through the COS. So we're gonna send the URL out. I guess is the easiest thing to do in email, and then anybody that I have the Skype for, I'll drop it in your Skypes. Like Nikki, I have yours, and I think I have most everybody here. So between Holly and I'm sorry, I'm having a brain fart. I can't remember his name. How come I can't think of one? Anyway, between us, we'll drop the presentation into your Skypes, and we'll give you the, we have it on YouTube. Let me see if I can even give the URL by mouth here for those that don't, we don't have it. Let me see, where is it here? Wait a minute. Well, hang on, let me go and pull it out of my Skype. Bear with me a minute.
You're talking about actually, Ron Flick.
Yeah, Ron Flick. Boy, I can't, unbelievable. I talk to him all the time. I couldn't remember the name. Ron Flick, yes. Anyway, if you go into YouTube and put in COS1-18Z in YouTube, you'll get that. COS1-18Z in the heading, and you'll get the Committee of Safety PowerPoint, basically, and go look at that, and then we'll talk about it next week. Nikki, I'm going to go ahead and let you finish.
Okay.
And then we'll want comments on these two things, because we're going to start working these into our local communities, because I think it's very important that we do get in our local communities. You know, I mean, I haven't done mine because I've been so busy on the national level, but I mean, my goodness, something hits the fan, none of us will be prepared if we don't start making inroads like yesterday. Okay?
I hear you. And actually, this is a good breaking point, because now I'm getting into the nuts and bolts of how to set up in a community and why, and what the process was prior to. So we could say, go to the 1 hour point and start from there. Okay, so... all right, so much of what I'm going to be reading from here on out will be from George Edwards, The Grand Jury, 1906, and this portion is about the development of the grand jury. Okay, so it starts out, in England during the 1200s and early 1300s, the court and the sheriffs established a practice of paneling accusing bodies known as inquests or juries, okay? So they were called inquests. They weren't always called juries. For every group of 100, and many of you who go back as long as I do with following, you know, the setup of the juries, going back 20 years or so, there was a fellow who wrote a book on, committees of 100 or something like that. Anyway, he talked about the 100, okay? We're going to find out why this failed, though, okay? For every group of 100 people, 4 to 16 people were summoned by the court bailiffs to be accusers and present offenses occurring within that 100. This practice was established because the king felt there was not a sufficient constabulary and more surveillance was needed over the population. The king felt there were too many people and too few sheriffs, where have we heard that before, and deputies to monitor the population. So the people were conscripted to be snitches, according to Edwards. The inquest juries of the 100s were impaneled to be an arm of the central government, acting as a public prosecutor for the purpose of ferreting out crime. So that's why we have law enforcers now rather than, peacekeepers. Okay, so the members of the inquest were at all times bound to inform the court, either singly or collectively, their reasons for arriving at their verdict and the evidence upon which it was based. These inquest juries reported to the court evidence of crimes based on personal knowledge. The court had the power to interrogate the inquest juries concerning their knowledge and to how they arrived at their presentments. These inquest juries were conscripted tattlers, according to Edwards. If offenses were not reported, the jurors would be heavily penalized. The grand jury was officially defined in 1368. So due to the increasing population over time, the inquest juries of the 100s became impractical. In 1368, during the reign of Edward III, the sheriffs began to expand the proceedings of inquest juries to investigate and present offenses for the entire county at large. The number of jurors for each county inquest was increased to 24. This body received the name La Grande Inquest, which means the Grand Inquisition. This is the first official reference of the grand jury. So the grand jury after began to gain independence. When the grand inquest was established to investigate the presence and present for the entire county, the jurors' personal knowledge of the facts in most cases became more limited. Hence, the practice of juror interrogation and requiring the grand inquest to divulge to the court their knowledge and reasons upon which their presentment was based began to fall into disuse. The grand juries eventually became secret because the grand inquest presented crimes for an entire county. The monarchy became more concerned that the actions of the grand inquest might become known to the accused and therefore would allow for the defendant's escape. The inquest were then sworn under oath to keep their proceedings secret. The grand juror took an oath that they will, and this was their oath, that they will lawful presentment make of such chapters as shall be delivered to them in writing, and in this they will not fail for any love, hatred, fear, reward, or promise, and they will conceal the secrets, so help them God and the saints. According to Edwards, this is what the oath was that they took. The development of the grand jury with the arrival of the grand inquest to inquire and present for the county at large, combined with the disappearance of the accusing bodies of the hundreds, we practically complete what may be termed the period of formation in the development of the grand jury. The independence of the grand jury became established, and it was in this period that the independence of the grand jury became established. Grand juries were no longer required to make known to the court the evidence upon which they acted, nor the reasons for their conclusion. They met in secret and were sworn to keep their proceedings secret by an oath which contained no reservations in favor of the government. The three centuries that followed documents grand juries' freedom of action from all restraints by the court. So the grand jury has no restraints by the court. The independence which the institution had attained would be put to severe test, however, since grand juries were protected by the cloak of secrecy and free from the control of the court concerning their findings. They successfully thwarted the unjust design of the corrupt monarchical government. That's kind of like what we're going to have to do, it looks like, sometimes, in some areas anyway. By the 1600s, grand juries were strongly asserting their independence and began functioning as the people's shield from the Crown's abusive prosecution against political dissidents. Now remember, they dissolved the political ban 1776. That was the priority. And it says right here, by the 1600s, grand juries were strongly asserting their independence and began functioning as the people's shield from the Crown's abusive prosecution against political dissidents. In other words, the Parliament with the Whigs and the Tories back then. It was the reign of Charles II that we find the two most celebrated instances of the fearless action of the grand jury in defending the liberty of the individual, although subjected to the strongest possible pressure from the Crown. And it goes into a couple of cases here. The case of Stephen College, a religious and political dissident, in 1681 during the reign of Charles II, a bill of indictment for high treason was submitted to the grand jury of the City of London against Stephen College, a Protestant joiner. Breaking protocol, Lord Chief Justice North compelled the grand jury to hear the evidence in open court. Concerning the witnesses who testified, it was said, "It is certainly true that never men swore more firmly in court than they did." The grand jury then demanded that the witnesses be sent to them that they might examine them privately. After considering the matter for several hours, the grand jury ignored the bill. See, this is what we need to do if we come together as grand jurors. Upon being asked by the Lord Chief Justice to give a reason for this verdict, they replied that they had given their verdict according to their consciences and would stand by it. According to their consciences, their group consciousness. Okay? The jurors exercised their right of secrecy of deliberations and refused to be interrogated by the court concerning their findings. The jury didn't have to, go before, these prosecutors or Lord Chief Justice or whatever. The foreman of the grand jury, Mr. Wilmore, was afterward apprehended upon a false charge, examined by the counsel, sent to the Tower, and afterward forced to flee beyond the sea. So he's pretty much exiled for doing that. But, this is the chance we're going to have to take if we want changes. Then there was the case of Anthony Cooper, the Earl of Shaftesbury, a religious and political dissident. During the mid-1600s, Anthony Cooper, the Earl of Shaftesbury, was a member of Parliament and supported a strong Parliament as well as religious tolerance. He became suspicious of the King's efforts to improve the position of Roman Catholics. Now remember, the King's, prior to that had, taken on the fealty of Pope Innocent III. Okay, so Cooper opposed the King and sided with parliamentarians in the English Civil Wars of the mid-1600s. In 1681, the same year as the College case, an attempt was made to indict Cooper for high treason. As in College's case, the grand jury desired to hear the evidence in private, as was standard procedure, but the King's counsel insisted that the evidence be heard in open court, and Lord Chief Justice Pemberton assented. Just as in Stephen College's case, after hearing the evidence in open court, the grand jury desired that they might examine the witnesses privately in their chamber, and the court granted the request. After again hearing the witnesses and considering their verdict, they returned the bill ignoramus, upon which the people fell a hollowing and a shouting. That's what it says in the book, okay? In other words, they were laughing. Ignoramus, okay? So King Charles unsuccessfully tries to retaliate. Because of the failure of the King to coerce the grand juries to his oppressive purpose, the King's officials sought a method whereby justice might be served with results more agreeable to their royal masters. A statute was enacted empowering judges and justices to reform grand jury panels by taking out the names of improper persons and putting in others according to their discretion. Isn't that what they do with juries now? The sheriff was then to be required to return the panel as reformed by the court. The Crown's excuse for this statute was an alleged abuse of power by the sheriffs regarding the selection and returning of grand jurors. And so if you had a good sheriff, you know, back then, you were okay. If not, you had the same problems we're having today, it seems. They accused the sheriffs of packing the panels with those who would carry out any alleged nefarious designs of the sheriff. Through the statute, Sir Robert Sawyer, an attorney general, sought to employ to carry out the wishes of the Crown. The court session of sessions endeavored to compel the sheriffs to return the panels as they directed, but the sheriffs refused, and grand juries' rules of secrecy allowed them to function out of sight of the king's prosecutors and other meddlers. Hopefully we'll get to that particular point. It was their secrecy that provided the grand juries with their greatest power as an independent populist body, an assembly, so to speak, equipped with oversight powers on the government. They were a group of people who stood as a check on government, often in direct opposition to the desires of those in power. This is what the First Amendment was all about. The grand juries are brought to America. When the settlement of America was begun by Englishmen, they brought with them all the civil rights which they enjoyed in their native land, and with them came the grand jury. The grand juries became one of the fundamental foundations of common law in the American colonies and is the oldest institution in America's criminal justice system. Grand juries quickly became vehicles for popular monarchical ideology for the English colonists in America. Grand juries gained strength and independence. In the early American experience, the grand jury became more a part of local government than it ever had been in England. A grand jury in Virginia in 1662 would meet two times a year to levy taxes and oversee spending, supervise public works, appoint local officials, and consider criminal accusations. Connecticut grand juries were elected and were levying taxes and conducting local government work by the middle of the 1700s. In many colonies, grand jurors gathered from all the several parts of the country to represent the state. Pre-revolutionary writers similarly spoke of grand juries as representative bodies. The New York Weekly Journal stated in 1734, "Does not the grand jury, those chosen by the sheriff, represent the county? In a manner of speaking, yes, grand jurymen represented not a group of constituents, but local knowledge." So if the assembly knew something and brought it to the jury acted on it. The grand jury was the initiator of prosecutions acting in several of the colonies as spokesmen for the people and as vehicles for complaints against officialdom. In America, the grand jury originally began as a defense against the monarchy and became much more independent than the English grand juries of the 1600s. American grand juries initiated prosecutions against corrupt agents of the British government, often in response to complaints from individuals. Grand jury's crucial role in the American Revolution was in pre-revolutionary America, grand juries took on a life of their own. The grand jury that the drafters of the Bill of Rights knew was much more powerful than any known in England. And this is going to the Committees of Safety. The actions of grand juries figured prominently in the beginning of the Revolution. In 1765, a Boston grand jury refused to indict colonists who had led riots against the Stamp Act. A Philadelphia grand jury condemned the use of the tea tax to compensate British officials, encouraged a rejection of the British goods, and called for organization with other colonies to demand redress of grievances. A Boston grand jury in 1769 indicted British soldiers for alleged crimes of breaking and entering private homes of citizens. Grand juries refused to indict certain colonists who had been charged by the British authorities for inciting desertion and other alleged crimes against the king. Grand juries indicted for treason anyone who joined or colluded with the British army. Grand juries function as patriotic platforms and propaganda machines, constantly condemning the British government and encouraging individuals to support the effort of independence. In some cases, the call to arms were sounded by the grand jurors themselves. In others, the sparks came from patriotic oratory by the presiding judges in their charges to the grand jury. The public proclamations of these grand juries were drastically different than anything we know today. And this is going back to 1906 he's talking about. They were often circulated in local national newspapers in an effort to fuel the revolutionary fire. Grand juries in early America protected Aaron Burr from false charges of treason. Aaron Burr was targeted by the federal government as early as 1800. After a bizarre political career, Burr was disliked by both Federalists and Republicans. The U.S. Attorney for Kentucky, a staunch Federalist, aligned with President Jefferson, moved that the grand jury be summoned to consider charges against Burr for his alleged attempt to involve the United States in a war with Spain. The grand jury from Republican-dominated Kentucky returned an ignoramus bill. I like that word, ignoramus bill, declining to indict Burr on the evidence. Going even further, the grand jury issued a written declaration in its presentment directed to the court in which they declared that Burr failed to exhibit any design inimical to the peace and well-being of the country. A second grand jury proceeding convened in Mississippi Territory to consider similar treason charges against Burr relating to his expedition down the Mississippi River. It was alleged that Burr intended to capture New Orleans, a city of 9,000 people protected by 1,000 United States soldiers using 60 unarmed men in 10 boats. The Mississippi grand jury not only declined to indict Burr in the affair, but returned presentments which clearly labeled the government's attempted charges as vindictive prosecution. We can do this, folks. The presentment concluded that Aaron Burr had not been guilty of any crime or misdemeanor against the laws of the United States or of this territory. Grand juries in early America exposed political corruption. Furthermore, the grand jury declared that the arrest of Burr and his co-travelers had been made without warrant and without other lawful authority and represented a grievance destructive of personal liberty. Okay, so these are some key words. Without warrant, without lawful authority, a grievance destructive of personal liberty, which is a lot of the things that we're dealing with today. In resounding condemnation, the grand jury pronounced its regret that the enemies of our glorious Constitution had rejoiced in the attempted persecution of Aaron Burr and expressed the opinion that such prosecutorial misconduct must sap the vitals of our political existence and crumble this glorious fabric into the dust, and which it has, hasn't it? The grand jury's presentment power was used not only to accuse wrongdoers when government prosecutors refused to do so, but to publicly declare the innocence of a targeted suspect in the very face of opposition by the prosecution. So it's not enough just to point out who's at fault, but to show that the other was not at fault. The Mississippi grand jury was a runaway, by today's standards. Yet, a grand jury acting in such way offered precisely the type of protection envisioned by the framers when they included the institution in the Bill of Rights as a check on the power of the government. The Mississippi grand jury presentment included a bold attack on the prosecution itself, an occurrence scarcely imaginable today. And this is 1906. 1913 has happened since then. 1932 or 33, you know, with Roosevelt's New Deal has happened since then. It was the grand jury's power over its presentments rather than its indictments that made it so fearsome. Now, going back, the presentments are something that we can do. The effectiveness of early American grand juries is stuttering out the shortcomings of the public officials can be gauged from the long list of grand jury presentments of early America. Very little escaped the attention of grand jury men, which even took notice of failures of town councils to provide stocks or a whipping post to punish such offenders. Throughout the 19th century, grand juries often acted on their own initiative in the face of direct opposition from a district attorney. Even though they had acted in their own initiative in opposition, they continued on. An independently acting grand jury probed and toppled the notorious Boss Tweed and his cronies in New York City in 1872. Without the prosecutor's assistance, the Tweed grand jury independently carried out its own investigation in a district that had otherwise been very loyal to Tweed. The media played a crucial role in this. The NYT, which I'm assuming is the New York Times, highly publicized the case despite being offered $5 million to keep it quiet. In 1902, a Minneapolis grand jury on its own initiative hired private detectives to collected enough evidence to indict the mayor and force the police chief to resign. This grand jury virtually governed the city until a new administration could be hired. In 1907, in San Francisco, a grand jury indicted the mayor and replaced him. Folks, we can do this today. We still have the power and the entitlement to do this under the correct laws. So anyway, I have a kind of like an insert here because in 1892, the Uniform Law Commission started to provide states with nonpartisan, well-conceived and well-drafted legislation that brings clarity and stability to critical areas of state and statutory laws. The ULC, the Uniform Law Commission, and I'm putting this in as a side because this came in 1892. So in 1906, already Edwards was beginning to notice the shift. ULC members must be lawyers qualified to practice law. They are practicing lawyers, judges, legislators, and legislative staff and law professors who have been appointed by state governments as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands to research, draft, and promote enactments of uniform state laws in areas of state laws where uniformity is desirable and practical. These people are still doing this, and you can look on their website, the Uniform Law Commission, the ULC website, and you'll see what's going on in your state that you may want to take notice of, what it is that they're trying to do in order to make it easier for themselves so that grand juries, you know, they can kind of push us aside or the people aside. because it's all about compliance. If you do not comply, you're going to be duly convicted of a crime. In conclusion now, okay, comes now the imperative role of the private private prosecution. In England, every private person has the same rights as the Attorney General to initiate a prosecution. If it was in England back then, it's here today. We have the same right as an Attorney General to initiate a prosecution. And I know that some of the people are involved with the private attorney generals. Just to, you know, have you aware that there is, it has to be taken, they have to have some place to go. And if it is to a locally structured common law grand jury that will go by the conscience of the people as it applies to the Ten Commandments, who's coveting, who's stealing, name the names, point out the what the indictments ought to be, so on, presentments, I guess is the better word. I'm learning just as well as you. Okay, so once the case has been presented to the grand jury, it was entirely out of the prosecutor's hands. All they have to do is present, even if it's a private person, an individual, to present it. In the early days of our republic, a prosecutor was simply anyone who voluntarily went before the grand jury with a complaint. Whether it was true or not true was up to the grand jury to decide based on their investigation. Until 1853, there was nowhere a general organized control of federal prosecution. The Department of, and this is the closing sentence here, okay? The Department of Justice was not created until June 22, 1870. At the time, the only authority the Justice Department had was to investigate postal crimes and compile crime statistics. Oops, there's more. Even in 1897, private citizens could still have arrest warrants issued. At that time, grand jurors themselves were the only ones competent to ascertain who was the prosecutor. The rise of public prosecutor, both at the federal and state levels, had drastically altered grand jury function. That doesn't mean it's still not there. It's just not functioning right because we, the people, are not involved. Of the 448 cases examined in 1838, there were 80 no bills. In 1976, there were 23,000 federal indictments returned, but only 123 no bills. And I tried to look for the latest statistics and couldn't find them. So anyway, if you believe, okay, if you have already completed the NLA Civics and Constitution courses and believe you have the gift for this type of administration pursuant to, and I'm throwing the scripture out there, to 1 Corinthians 12, okay, because we're all given certain gifts, access the COS handbook on the NLA site, follow the instructions contained therein, and a competent structure for grand jury administration within the committees of safety is a priority of utmost importance. Cannot stress that enough. I yield, and that's the end of this presentation.
Well, thank you, Nikki.
You're welcome. Sorry, I went over time. Any questions, comments? Everyone hang
on. Awesome.
Yeah, there's guns are in Oregon. It seems like back in the colonial days when the revolution was on that the grand juries were working in where there wasn't any committees of safety. So they were adding a supplement to connect the community with the movement, the revolution.
Yeah, and the country was still growing at that time, so there were new people coming in all the time. It was just a matter of time before, you know, something like that would happen. However, you know, Reconstruction came in a tad too soon, and especially with the Industrial Revolution, you know, where, you know, the big bosses with their railways and stuff like that wanted to take over coal mines and stuff. anyway.
Yeah, and just before the Organic Act, they started controlling the grand juries, so
let's see what's going on there. Yeah, thank you, Nikki. Right, really appreciate your work.
Yeah. We still have the power and the authority and the entitlement to so do, and it's actually been our fault that, you know, for like a generation we've done, or a couple of generations, we've done absolutely nothing, you know. We just imbibed with the the creator of wealth, you know, mammon, rather than the laws of nature and nature's God. Anyway, it's interesting tying this all together historically.
Well, that's where I want to jump in.
Sure.
A message that I would like to impart is right along the lines of what you just said, and has to do with the history. With whatever knowledge the people listening tonight possess, if you've been following us from the beginning as we've gone through the historical context of both the committees of safety and now we've moved into the grand jury, you find that there are cycles. As our historic presentation shows us, these cycles repeat. These things have been around. They come and they go. We have historic facts of these cycles. And the colonists dealing with the COSs and with the grand juries dealt with exactly the same things that we're dealing with today. It's another cycle. So we have all of this knowledge of history that shows us how effective that is. And this presentation tonight was quite exciting because Nikki cited several examples of what grand juries have already done in the past. So that's a thought that I wanted to leave with everybody. And with that, I yield.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, John.
I have a question for you. What's the source of your material there? I know you mentioned Michael Bednarik.
Well, it looks like this would be a good place to call it quits tonight. We're about 40 minutes overdue. So
somebody had a